Okay, are we ready? Today I want to talk about a very important example of one and two dimensional bifurcations that will illustrate all of the bifurcations we've talked about so far, and we'll also introduce several new ones. And I want to start by introducing you to an experimental system that was very important in driving the model example I'm going to talk about. And these studies were done in the 1970s on bistability and oscillations in chemical reaction systems, which was something of a curiosity back in the 70s. Maybe you recall there were a few scattered examples of bistability reported in chemical reaction systems in the first part of the 20th century, maybe three or four altogether in 50 years. And then in the 60s, there were these rumors coming out of the Soviet Union of an oscillating chemical reaction, which became known as the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction. And it was finally reported in 1968 in Prague at an international meeting in Prague. The Jabotinsky gave a talk about his reaction and gave the recipe for doing this reaction, and used very simple chemicals that are available in almost any chemistry department. So all the Western scientists hurried back to their labs and started working on this Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction, which involved the oxidation of some simple organic substrates like malonic acid with bromate ions and transition metal catalysts. And people got very intrigued by the properties of the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction and started doing little tricks and extensions of the BZ reaction. And a group that was especially important here was this group at the CNRS in Bordeaux, France, headed by Paco. And they did two things. I don't know if they were the first, but they introduced the idea of running the BZ reaction and similar reactions in a continuous flow stirred tank reactor. And it's illustrated on this slide in the far right, a little sketch of a reaction vessel with a stirring bar in it to keep it stirred up and homogeneous, and it has an inflow and an outflow. So you flow in the chemical reactants for this reaction, and then you just let the reactor overflow. So there's a continual supply of new chemicals. And that way, you can study the oscillations in the reaction over a long period of time. There'll be sustained oscillations for as long as you keep feeding the reactor. So this was an important improvement of the batch mode that the oscillations had been studied in. And secondly, they started exploring other kinds of chemical reactions, other oxidizing agents, other oxidants, and reductants and catalysts. So they just started making variants of the basic BZ reaction. And they studied the behavior of the system in this flow reactor, and essentially they created experimentally two-parameter bifurcation diagrams, although that's not what they called them, and they didn't really think of them that way at first. They called them phase diagrams, and I think the analogy here in physical chemistry, a phase diagram is like pressure and temperature, and you look at the phases, whether it's a solid, liquid, or a gas of a substance as a function of pressure and temperature. Here they were asking, what's the behavior of this reactor as a function of two control variables, not pressure and temperature, but two parameters. I call them parameter one and parameter two here, but the parameters that they were using on the x-axis was always the flow rate through the reactor, the rate in milliliters per minute at which new stuff is coming into the reactor and washing out of the reactor. So that's something that's easily controlled by the experimenter. You just turn a dial and you can change the flow rate, change the pump speed. And then the second parameter that they were using was usually the concentration of one of the reactants in the feed stream. So if they're using bromate ions as the oxidizing agent, then they would control the bromate concentration on the input stream in, you know, so many moles per liter or something like that. Okay? And then they mapped out, you know, at each combination of these two parameters, they'd put a little dot and they'd say what the reactor was doing. And over again, they saw this situation diagrammed here, which they called a cross-shaped phase diagram. So if you looked at the pattern of the behavior of the reactor, you found this X that divided the parameter plane into four sections. And in one section, the reaction showed bistability. And diagonally across the crossing point, the reactor usually showed spontaneous oscillations. So it would either be bistable or it would be oscillatory. And then on the sides, it just showed the boring, single, stable, steady state. So they called this the cross-shaped phase diagram, and actually they used it as a very reliable tool for creating new oscillating chemical reactions. And the idea was, you look in your inorganic chemistry book for some evidence of autocatalysis in a chemical reaction, and it's not too uncommon, actually. And you take that autocatalytic reaction and you put it into a flow reactor and you twiddle your parameters, the flow rate and concentrations, looking for the system to show bistability. Because in an autocatalytic reaction, they tend to show bistability under these conditions, because either the autocatalytic reaction turns itself on and you produce lots of the autocatalytic stuff, or if the flow rate is too high or something like that, then the autocatalytic reaction can never get started and it's kept in the off state. And so they would just control the conditions to try to find this intermediate zone where the reaction could show bistability. And then they used their cross-shaped phase idea to follow the bistability region. And essentially the bistability region, as they mapped it out in their phase diagram, would point to a place where the system would show oscillations. And very, very reliably, always showed oscillations on the other side of bistability. And a whole new classes of chemical oscillators were discovered in this way. So it was very important from an experimental point of view, from the kind of chemistry of oscillating chemical reactions. Okay, but why this cross-shaped phase diagram kept showing up over and over again was an important theoretical question that people didn't really understand for a while, until a famous paper by John Guggenheimer was published in the 1980s. And there were other theoreticians before Guggenheimer who had the basic idea, but Guggenheimer presented a simple mathematical example that illustrated the cross-shaped phase diagram in beautiful detail. So let's have a look at the next slide. Okay, so the toy model that Guggenheimer proposed is written on the top of this slide, number 41. It's just two nonlinear differential equations for X and Y. It's a very mathematical model. This is not chemistry. You can't interpret X and Y as concentrations of chemicals. But we'll give him that. We'll take this as an example, as an illustrative example. And I'll just assure you that you can turn this into good chemistry, and exactly a very similar picture shows up. It's just easier to see the bifurcations in this toy mathematical model. But I'll just point out a few things. The equation for X shows what we might call autocatalysis, because the rate of production of X is proportional to the concentration of X. The more X you have, the faster you make X. That's the first term in the differential equation. So that's the autocatalytic term. The second term says X is removed from the system at a rate proportional to X cubed. That's not very good chemistry, but it makes the mathematics a lot easier. That's a rate of removal of this X stuff, so it doesn't grow too large. If we have an autocatalytic process going on, it tends to explode, And so when the X concentration gets large, you want to make sure that X is destroyed very rapidly, and that's what the minus X cubed term does. The minus lambda term is really bad. It looks like really bad chemistry, especially if lambda is positive. Actually, lambda will be able to take both positive and negative values, but that's going to be one of our control parameters, the lambda term. You can think of it as something like the flow rate in the chemical reactor, although it's not very closely connected. Okay, and the other control parameter in the system is going to be this rate constant K, which tells you how X is removed by this other species Y. Okay, I'm not trying to defend the chemistry. The chemistry is no good at all, but the model is quite cute. Another problem with the model, while I'm dealing with problems, another problem with the model is it has a lot of symmetry in it, which is also unusual for chemistry. Chemistry doesn't usually have the symmetry. And the symmetry that I'm talking about is if you replace X by minus X and lambda by minus lambda, then you get the same equations back again. So there's a symmetry with respect to change of sign of the variable and the parameter. And that symmetry in the differential equations will show up as a symmetry in the bifurcation diagram. And that symmetry leads to some curiosities of the bifurcation diagram that are not generic and that will break when we break the symmetries, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So the bifurcation diagram has some simplicities to it because of the symmetry, and those simplicities will be broken when you break that symmetry. But with all those caveats, this is still a very important model and very illustrative of the kinds of two-parameter bifurcation diagrams that you see in these molecular regulatory systems. Okay? So let's start. What are we hoping to see? We're hoping to see something like a cross-shaped phase diagram in a two-parameter space, and the parameters are lambda and k. So I've started to sketch out what we're hoping to see in the two parameters, k and lambda. And we want to see a cross-shaped phase diagram. Well, the V-shaped region where we see bistability, that we get for free, right? Because that's what we expect to see. We expect to see a cusp, and inside the cusp, the system should be bistable. Okay. The question is, where do the oscillations come from? And the oscillations, remember, the cusp points to the oscillatory region. So the oscillations have to appear out here for large values of k, and there's a domain of oscillations out there. And usually that domain is closed. It almost looks like a balloon, and the cusp is a needle or something that you're using to inflate a balloon. And there's this balloon of oscillations that kind of puffs out at the end of the needle of the cusp-shaped region. And that balloon that encloses the oscillatory domain, we would expect comes from a locus of Hopf bifurcations. So I've just sketched in here to get started a cusp-shaped region in lambda k and a balloon of Hopf bifurcation that puffs out to the right that has the oscillatory region. And then above and below, we expect the system to show monostability, a single stable steady state. Okay? Now let's ask ourselves, what do we expect the state space to look like for this toy model under these conditions? Now, if you look at the toy model, the x dt is a cubic equation. So if I plot the x null line, to plot the x null line, I set the right-hand side equal to 0 and solve for y as a function of x. And y as a function of x is just going to be a simple cubic curve. Okay, so that's what I've plotted out here to the right, say, in the oscillatory region. I'm plotting the state space, y versus x, and I'm plotting the null lines in the state space. The x null line is a cubic curve, and the vector field is vertical. and the linoc line is just x equal y. It's just the straight line with a 45 degree slope, and that's where the vector field is horizontal. Okay? And if the two nulk lines intersect once in the middle, then we can expect that for the right values of k, the system will show spontaneous oscillations. And I've sketched in a limit cycle around an unstable steady state in that region of the state space. Okay? Now, if we move to the left-hand side of the figure, within the cusp region, then the system shows a bistability. And in that case, the linear nulk line intersects the cubic nulk line three times, two stable steady states and one unstable steady state. That's quite expected. Okay? And above and below, we have the case where there's a single stable steady state, and in that case, the linear nulk line intersects the cubic nulk line on one of the extreme branches, and there we have stable steady states. Okay? So around the outside of this cross-shaped diagram, it's very simple to see why the system behaves the way it does. The question is, how do we fit these pictures together? What are the bifurcations that organize this diagram? And in particular, in the center of this diagram, around the cusp, what other dynamical behaviors can we expect to see? And we'll see right away now that things get very complex in the center of this diagram. Any questions so far? You with me? Yes, Pramita? Well, okay, if you go out further from what I've drawn here, you don't see anything new. These four pictures that I've drawn around the outside are the four pictures that just occupy most of the parameter space. Okay? But the question is, if those are the... It's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, right? How do you put together a jigsaw puzzle? A 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, okay? You spread it out on the table. What's the first thing you do? You find the edge pieces, right? You find the edge pieces. They're the easiest ones to find. And you put together the edge pieces, and you get the picture around the edge. Then you start working on the center, right? That's what we're doing here. We've got the pictures around the edge, and now we want to fill in the center. But the center is always the hard part to do, right? So you leave it aside, and you go off to the movies or something like that and hope somebody works on it while you're away, because it's so frustrating. Okay, so we're going to try to fill in the center of this jigsaw puzzle. Okay? Now, because we studied some two-parameter bifurcations, we can begin to guess what we need to see here, right? I mean, we've already had a bonus because we know about the cusp. The cusp is a two-parameter bifurcation point, a codimension two bifurcation point. And we see from the diagram that we have, in some sense, we have a locus of Hopf bifurcations that's puffed out from the cusp. But if you follow that locus of Hopf bifurcations back, somehow they have to interact with the saddle node bifurcations that have created the cusp. And how do Hopf bifurcations and saddle node bifurcations interact with each other? Well, by Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation. So we might guess, as illustrated at the bottom of slide 41, that the locus of Hopf bifurcations comes into the bistable region and attaches to the saddle nodes at Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcations. And the locus of Hopf bifurcations, they cross over each other in the middle of the bistable region, and they attach to the saddle node on the opposite side. This is a good guess, and actually it's confirmed by the analysis of these differential equations. Okay? Now, how would we do that? How did Guggenheimer do it? I'm just guessing, but Guggenheimer had access to Otto or something like Otto, and I suspect what he did was he used auto to draw out the saddle node lines and then to follow the hop bifurcations. And you follow the hop bifurcations back, and indeed, auto will track the hop bifurcations back closer and closer and closer to the saddle node. And as it gets closer, it slows down and slows down because the period of the limit cycles gets longer and longer. But eventually it comes back and it kind of points to where the Takhmansbach-Donoff bifurcation is.
Okay?
Now, once you're close to the Takhmansbach-Donoff bifurcation, you know that there has to be a saddle loop close by. So the next thing to do is some cuts in the parameter space close to the Takhmansbach-Donoff bifurcation, and you know which side to cut on so that you can see first the hop bifurcation and then the saddle loop bifurcation. And you can use auto to follow the saddle loop bifurcations away from the Takhmansbach-Donoff. Okay? You follow them in either direction. If you follow in one direction, the saddle loop will lead you back to the Takhmansbach-Donoff. If you follow in the other direction, the saddle loops will move across the bistable domain and do something. That's what we're going to see in the next slide. You with me so far? Okay? So you can use auto to start to fill in the picture here. But the other thing, I mentioned this last time, the hop bifurcations that create the stable limit cycle oscillations in the cross-shaped phase diagram are usually supercritical hop bifurcations. And you can confirm that for this problem, that out to the right where the oscillations live, that you have supercritical hop bifurcations. But if you get closer to the cusp region, the supercritical hop bifurcations change to subcritical hop bifurcations. Because when they finally attach to the Takhmansbach-Donoff, they're subcritical hop bifurcations. So this locus of hop bifurcation, it starts subcritical at a Takhmansbach-Donoff, changes to supercritical, loops around the cusp, changes back to subcritical, and then connects to the other Takhmansbach-Donoff bifurcation on the other side, okay? And where the hop bifurcations change from subcritical to supercritical, there's a degenerate hop bifurcation that throws off a locus of cyclic folds. And auto will follow the locus of cyclic folds as well. And we'll see what the cyclic folds do. Okay? So what I'm suggesting is as you start to fill in this jigsaw puzzle with the hints that we have from bifurcation theory, you can see that there are a lot of loci of bifurcations, and they all have to connect to each other in some kind of a sensible way. Let's have the next slide. Okay, so slide 42 now is the full bifurcation diagram that Guggenheimer calculated for this toy model by following all the loci of one parameter bifurcations. Okay? So first of all, you can see the cusp-shaped region starting in the lower left, going to the cusp point, and then sweeping to the upper left. That's the region of bistability. And on the far right here, just past the cusp, is the region of stable limit cycles. And the loci of hop bifurcations are indicated by an H, and they run across the bistable region and attach to two Takhmansbach-Donoff bifurcations on either side. And the degenerate hop bifurcations are indicated on the hop loci, and the degenerate hop bifurcations, they spin off a locus of cyclic folds, what I call cyclic folds, what Guggenheimer calls SNP, a saddle node of periodic orbits. It's where our stable and unstable periodic orbits come together and annihilate each other. He calls that a saddle node of periodic orbits. And you can see in this case that the saddle node of periodic orbits sweeps across the bistable region and just runs over to the other side and connects to the degenerate hop bifurcation on the other hop locus. Okay? Now, let me mention again that the bifurcation diagram shows a great deal of symmetry. In fact, it shows a symmetry, a reflection symmetry in lambda. Okay? K is in the horizontal direction, and lambda is in the vertical direction, and there's a symmetry with lambda going to minus lambda. That's why the bifurcation diagram shows this symmetry. And if we break that symmetry, even a little bit, all these curves will shift around a little bit and will break the symmetry of this diagram and actually introduce some new bifurcation points. But I want to delay that discussion until later. Let's try to understand this one first, okay? Makes it a little simpler. We're told from the outset that this jigsaw puzzle we're doing is symmetric, north and south, so you really only have to do half the puzzle, right? What about the saddle loops? Okay? So the saddle loop, following the saddle loops is where you find the big surprises. So let's start at the Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation in the lower left. Okay? And follow the saddle loop coming out of that Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation. Okay? A saddle loop, a locus of saddle loops, always has to lie inside the bistable region, because that's the only place where saddle points are, right? So it's inside the bistable region. It runs across the bistable region to a symmetry point called DL. And we follow it through the symmetry point, and it sweeps across to the other side, to the locus of saddle nodes on the far side of the bistable region. And there, the saddle loop connects to the saddle nodes at a bifurcation called an SNL, a saddle node loop, which I haven't described for you yet, but I will. And then, the saddle, in a sense, the saddle loop and the saddle node run together in this short section here. The saddle loop and the saddle node run together, and there it's called a SNC bifurcation, a saddle node invariant circle bifurcation, which we also haven't seen yet. And after a while, the SNC breaks apart again into a saddle node and a saddle loop. So now we've generated a new saddle loop, and we follow the new saddle loop. We leave the saddle node behind, we follow the new saddle loop. It runs across, back to the symmetry point, sweeps all the way across the bistable region, and then does the same trick on the other side. A saddle node loop bifurcation, some SNCs, a fourth saddle node loop, and we pick up the saddle here, the saddle loop here, and it runs through the symmetry point and over to the other Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation. Okay? So the saddle loops, they sweep back and forth across the domain and eventually connect the one Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation with the other Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation. Okay, you with me? So all of these are the loci of one parameter bifurcation curves. And they all fit together in a sensible way. There aren't any loose ends. And all of the loci of one parameter bifurcations end on this diagram at a two parameter bifurcation point. So, in a sense, we've put together the jigsaw puzzle and all the pieces fit together. Okay? If you just look at the shape of the pieces, all the pieces fit together, and there aren't any pieces missing, and we haven't jammed two pieces together that don't fit. Okay? So we've assembled the jigsaw puzzle, but in a sense, we've assembled it blind, because we haven't asked ourselves, what are the pictures on the puzzle look like? It's like we put together the puzzle backwards, okay? We turned all the pieces upside down, so we couldn't see the pictures. And we just put the puzzle pieces together based on their shape. Okay? Now, I mean, sounds like a fun way to do a jigsaw puzzle. Now, we flip it over and we see whether we really did it right or not. what do the pieces look, what do the pictures look like, and do the pictures fit together? So let's have the next slide. So here are two figures from Guggenheimer's paper, figure 7 and figure 8. Figure 7 is just the figure that I showed you before, but now every little domain on this figure has a letter in it, A through N, and the letter tells you what the picture looks like on that piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And the little sketches are given in figure 8, the phase portraits that correspond to the regions of the two-parameter bifurcation diagram in figure 7. Okay? So the idea is to put these phase portraits into the little blocks of the jigsaw puzzle and convince yourself that everything fits together. You with me? Now, the only way to do this is to sit down in a quiet place with no disturbances and set aside a few hours to draw these pictures and convince yourself that everything fits together. Okay? But don't cheat. You make a copy of this and it's like doing a crossword puzzle, right? You don't just look at the answers. That's no fun. You try and do the crossword puzzle. When you get stuck, you go and look at the answers, okay? So the answers are here. This is the answer sheet, but put that away in a safe place, okay? Give it to your wife or husband or boyfriend to watch over while you work out on the blank tableau what has to happen in these different places, okay? And when you get really stuck, then you have to ask for help and you get points deducted or something like that. So, what I want to do now is turn off the projector and turn on the lights. I'm going to turn off the recorder and we'll work on the board and try and sketch out what this tableau has to look like. And there's no point in recording it because it's going to be kind of chaotic and it'll be completely unintelligible on the tape as we work on the board. Okay, so let's turn off the answers. Just go to the next slide. That's the best way to do it. Okay, so here's the blank tableau, and we'll try to fill this out.